come from actual church bulletins. And one reads, "Don't let worry kill you, let the church help." Remember in prayer the many who are sick of our church and community. For those of you who have children and don't know it, we have a nursery downstairs. The rosebud on the altar this morning is to announce the birth of David Allen Belzer, the son of Reverend and Mrs. Julius Belzer. This afternoon, there will be a meeting in the south and north ends of the church. Children will be baptized at both ends. I would like to read an article that I wrote on discipleship earlier this year. Discipleship comes as a strange word to us in this modern world. In distant past, the use of the word was commonplace and better understood. With the advent of modern psychology and philosophy, the idea of developing the ego and to not be overly dependent on anyone has come to the fore. Personal independence and self-actualization, our goal. Can the word discipleship have any value or meaning in such a time as ours? The answer is a resonant yes. This answer is based on the experience and testimony of modern-day spiritual mystics and their students. These individuals are not, as is sometimes widely believed to be, unbalanced fanatics. Reasonable adults of emotional maturity have and do benefit from the relationship of a guru-teacher-disciple relationship. The word guru means from darkness to light. In other words, that which leads one from the darkness of ignorance in our oneness with God to the light of that realization. The commonplace fear of losing one's personal authority or common sense becomes irrelevant under the tutelage of a bona fide teacher. Such a teacher or guru does not ask one to give up either their personal authority or their common sense. Even as a university professor needs a student to come to class with an open mind and a willingness to learn, so does a spiritual teacher desire this in their disciple student. Personal authority of the student surrenders itself to openness and receptivity toward instruction for the duration of the course. While the university professor deals almost exclusively with the mind of the student, the guru works with the whole being of the student. It is not surprising that to most of society this sounds a threatening thing to do. To modern-day Christians, disciple relationship does not require the day-to-day surrender to a God-realized individual. They can imagine, when doing so is convenient for them, to choose what sayings or lessons they desire to learn and in what order. The ego of individuality is less threatened with this comfortable distance. However, how well would modern-day disciples measure up if they were confronted with a living Jesus Christ? Would they leave their nets, their work, and become beggars going from town to town? In facing the resistance from established religions, Christian churches included, I wonder how many takers that Christ would have. Doubts would surely rise when confronted with humanity, the humanity, and inner struggles of such a one. Read carefully the pages of the apostles. Who today would be able to follow such a one? This is said to point out the real difficulty discipleship represents. Further, who would leave all, families and friends included, and venture forth with nothing guaranteed, even unto public humiliation and death? Again, how many would embrace such a life? The challenges of discipleship represent such choices. For what purpose would one leave all the familiar things of this world for such a life? There can be only one answer. It must be at God's instigation. The inner drive to know God must be to such a degree that no ordinary means of learning can be adequate to the task. With heart, mind, and soul, The disciple must be willing to go through anything to find fulfillment of their life's urging. This can be no ordinary need, but must come from the depths of the soul. Anything less will amount to spiritual seeds being sown in shallow or rocky ground. For trials and temptations will surely arise. In this sense, no ordinary teacher can suffice for such a seeker. Only one who has gone the way themselves can lead another from darkness to light. Still, how is the self-realized master to be recognized? No university can train or grant degrees in self-mastery. No amount of world fame or oratory skill can indicate realization, and certainly no organization can substitute for a realized master. The term master here denotes one who has gained mastery over their ego and surrendered it to the infinite master. A realized master is known only to God and to those whom God has given the eyes to see. It is said that it takes a master to recognize another master. So what hope can there be for one who, by definition, is in darkness? If that one is a sincere seeker of truth, then God will surely lead them to a realized master. Jesus said the sheep will recognize their shepherd's voice, and certainly this seems to be the case. In my own life, I met and became a disciple of such a one. At the time, I was sincerely seeking the company of one who had in their life what I sought to have in my own, namely, universal consciousness. On our first meeting, my guru, Mother Hamilton, lifted my consciousness up, and I experienced a greater degree of realization than I had ever had before. It was through the repeated performance of that miracle of transformed consciousness that gradually I came to know and trust in her as my spiritual teacher, my guru. Surely no greater miracle could have done more for me than this feat. Once, while in her presence, I looked into her eyes. I felt myself falling into those fathomless wells of eternity. At first, I had hesitated. Then I thought, no, this is what I am here to do. So I let go and felt myself falling without end. Suddenly, I landed with a jolt right in my own heart center. I realized then, this is where Mother is, right in my own heart. Through the years of discipleship with Mother, both with and without a body, I have felt her spiritual presence, inner guidance, protection, and her ongoing miraculous power to uplift my consciousness. Through discipleship, the long-sought connection between me and the infinite reservoir of consciousness opened. The truth of it is that my discipleship with my guru has prepared me for discipleship with God consciousness. Mother had always echoed her guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, God is the master, we are all his disciples. Somehow God finds it his great joy that he uses his human instruments to bring himself in his finite human form to unparalleled superconscious of his divine self. It is, then, in the guru-disciple relationship that God in the form of the guru comes to show the way for the disciple. When you think about it, it is only on the plane of duality that God can give to God in this way. God, in his absolute eternal self, is one, and there can be no idea of God giving to God. However, on this plane of duality, God has become the many. Therefore, each of one of us is an indispensable part of the whole. God is calling each of us to fulfill our needed role in this divine drama. For a realized one, it may be to be the teacher, an open channel for God consciousness to come into the world. For another, to be a surrendered disciple. Surrender means to take those techniques taught and put them to work. Also, that the disciple should follow the example of the guru, even unto death of the ego. Ultimately, all become disciples of that highest consciousness, that is God. Each comes with their own gifts, so that God may give to God, and the whole may be greater than the sum of its parts. The teacher cannot teach without the willing disciple. God cannot give without a receptive soul. Also, the disciple brings their part of God to the work, sharing their light of God to their greatest ability in terms of their realization, talents, and support, so that all benefit from spiritual association. What can be accomplished with a group of like-minded souls will always be greater than an individual on their own. Therefore, it fulfills all righteousness for the guru-disciple relationship to be kept and honored, not for the sake of personal vainglory of the student or the teacher, but so that God may be more completely made manifest in the minds and hearts of all. And a reading from Yogananda's book, Whispers from Eternity. Thy gentle voice saying, come home. I have often heard, but it was drowned in the noises of wild cravings of many lives. I forsook the jostling crowds of desires. In the solitude of my mind, my devotion is bursting to hear thy voice. Take away the dreams of earthly sounds, which yet lurk in my mind. I want to hear thy quiet voice, ever singing in the silence of my soul. A saying from Guru Nanak, man is not born free, he is born to free himself. In the beginning, as we tread this path towards realization, we feel ourselves drawn along upon a particular path. We read perhaps many books and listen to different speakers, and we sample here and there the teachings of those different ones. But there comes a time in our spiritual search when we are drawn to a particular path. It is as if the eclectic student who has gathered information from hither and yon at last starts to have a major subject of study. When we first enter into a university, we get a generalized education, some in English, some in mathematics, some in history, and so on. But as we progress along, we have to choose a major, and from that, if we get advanced degrees, we have to narrow the field of study to even a more particular area. In doing so, we derive the benefit of being able to focus our attention on a narrow area so that we can make greater progress. If we keep our minds wide open to the eclectic whole, then we do not make the same kind of progress. And so it is with the spiritual path, that as we read different books and take on different methods perhaps along the way, finally, when the soul is ready to march onward toward that infinite consciousness, then we set aside and begin to cut through so much of all that we've been taught, and we begin to narrow in on those techniques that we have been taught. When we are ready, when we have a sincere desire for God realization, then we are drawn to that one who can take us the whole way. Now, these teachings and these techniques are of the highest order, and they have been designed in such a way that they focus the mind on the absolute and take away from many of the sidetracks that we can get involved with. We are taught in this way to not pay too much attention to the body, not pay too much attention to the emotions or to the thoughts, but go directly to this highest consciousness, setting aside everything else. With these techniques, we are able to approach the divine and begin to be uplifted in it. But it is not just techniques alone, but rather it is tuning in with a sensitive mind, a sensitive spirit, a sensitive soul, into the subtle vibrations of God consciousness. This is not about taking some laws or some rules and putting them up on an altar and worshiping them. Rather, it is taking some principles and techniques and putting them to work in your life and finding out what the results are. Now, this is a scientific path in the sense that it starts out with a proposition that we are all made in the image and likeness of God. Now, image is form. Through the various forms of the idea body or the causal body, descending then into the astral body or the electrical emotional body, and finally into this physical body in this human form, these three sheaves, or these three bottles of ignorance, remove our consciousness from our awareness that we are made up of infinite spirit. And so we become identified with these three bodily jars of the idea, the emotional, and the physical. And so in taking away these veils of ignorance, we have to progress back up, first of all, by setting aside the physical, calming the body, calming the appetites, calming all the urges that constantly pull at us, removing the sights and the sounds and all the distractions of this world. But then we come against the feelings. And within the feelings, we have emotions that drag us this way and that. And finally, the ideas that send us across a zillion miles in a second. One moment we can be meditating, and the next our minds are off racing toward yesterday, towards tomorrow, or all the things that we have to do in that day. And so almost without any thought, we are suddenly distracted and taken to distant places. So it is a consistent and constant calming of this body, of the emotions, and of the mind that we enter into a true state of stillness or tranquility. Now, in India, there was discovered, as these ancient rishis or these men and women of wisdom entered into their bodily temples, that is, this temple made without hands, this human body, that as they went within themselves and they stilled the breath, they found that there is an interrelationship between breath and mind. There is also a relationship between mind and feelings. And so as the body became still, the mind became still, and the emotions became still, there came the realization that we are made up of more than just this physical body to which we normally identify ourselves with. We are made up of more than our emotions and our feelings, and more than our thoughts. That what resided within us was a vast ocean of conscious awareness, where before the idea had been that we were limited to what we perceived directly around us in terms of the world. But when we withdrew our attention from the world, the life force was reversed from animating this body and lifted up through the spine into the brain, and from there, conscious realization of a greater reality came forward. Now, through experimentation, the best techniques were brought forward in order to make this realization available for anyone who decided to pursue this path. Now, this does not have to do so much with outside rituals, things that we do in this life in order to perhaps satisfy the mind alone, because this mind itself is part of the ignorance. Ideas themselves are limiting. And so we cannot just go on an intellectual trip, or even just upon an emotional trip, or something that just strictly has to do with the body. But we have to go within ourselves and go beyond all three before we can realize and understand who and what we are made of. And then, in that moment, we come to understand that we are made up of God stuff, of this consciousness that rises up above this body, above the feelings, and above the thoughts. And so this is the proposition. This is the idea that is put forward. Now, in true science, then, you need an experiment. in order to prove your hypothesis. And so the experiment is these meditative techniques. And it is said that if we put these meditative techniques to work, then we will get sure results. In the beginning, as we start to still the mind and the body, we feel a greater sense of well-being. We feel a greater sense of peace when the struggle between the body and the thoughts and the feelings begin to recede. Now, this doesn't happen in a moment, and this is true for everyone who puts themselves on the path. It's not something to become discouraged about. When we first try to go within, this mind is compared to be that with a monkey, and it jumps from limb to limb and is always active, is always on the go, is always marching forward or into the past. And it's really quite something to try to begin to tame that. I think I may have told some of you that there was a time that in my meditations, I would be blissfully going along and starting to feel the presence of God, when suddenly I would become aware for the last several minutes I was involved in a wrestling match that I had when I was in high school, that I had lost this particular match by 1 point. And suddenly I was replaying it in my mind, and I was going through even all the physical emotions. I felt my whole muscle, my whole body tightened up as I was straining against this imaginary foe that I was wrestling with. And here I'd been sitting on my meditation blanket, supposedly with my mind fixed on God, and I was almost sweating through the exertion of all the things I was going through in that moment. And so because there was an unfulfilled desire lodged with deep in my unconscious around this, my mind was drawn back to it until I was finally able to resolve that within my mind. And once having done so, it released the life energy that was stored up within my unconscious. And it made me know then that that released life force was able to help me then ascend the spinal stairway into my heavenly consciousness. So we all come up against these kinds of oppositions. Sometimes we have an unnamed fear within us. And perhaps we don't even know what we're afraid of, but we feel this fear about going deeper within our own unconscious. Perhaps it is the fear that if we go within ourselves, we will find out that truly we are not light beings made up of God stuff, but we are really something that is worthless or not worth having. Or perhaps we have a great fear of death, or perhaps that we are in reality a nothingness, if we are not this personality and this ego. And so these opposing forces come up and we begin to fight with them. And this is what it is to be on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. It is the uplifting and good forces that are trying to make progress on the spiritual path, but equal and opposing forces come up to stop us from progressing forward. Deep-seated angers or hatreds, jealousies, all these negative emotions start to erupt and come up out of the unconscious. And during those times, we do not feel as if we are very spiritual in that moment. We feel as if we are rooted in the very deepest, darkest areas of which we are not proud of, which we don't feel good about, and we don't feel like perhaps we even deserve to be on the spiritual path. But this idea that we don't deserve to be on the spiritual path is the ego that's whispering in our ear. It's trying to tell us that we shouldn't seek out something higher. We shouldn't seek out something greater within our own being. And so these subtleties sneak in, and they try to tempt us away from coming and going further along our own path towards our own spirituality. So this idea of dogged determination, of whatever comes, we will persist. Whatever the negative forces that come into our lives, whether they were outward or inward, we will not allow them to stop us from proceeding forward. And sometimes if we have perhaps stopped meditating for a while, or we feel we have gone off the spiritual path, or we have made mistakes, we kind of throw in the towel. You know, it's like if you're trying to change your habits around eating and you are real good for a while and then suddenly you have a deep craving for some chocolate or something. And so you have a little bit of a chocolate bar and suddenly, you know, you've eaten the whole cake, you know, and you just throw in the towel and you think, oh, it's all worthless. I'm worthless. I can't go on with this. When you become aware that you are indulging yourself in this way, stop. Just mentally put up a big red stop sign right in front of you and just say, stop, I'm not going to go further. I'm not going to take one more bite. I'm going to set this chocolate cake aside and I'm not going to eat any more of it. And I'm going to get back on track again. If you feel as if you've fallen down and bloodied your knees and your elbows, don't let that stop you. When you get aware of what you've done to yourself, then simply pick yourself up, dust your clothes off, and continue on your way. It is this kind of dogged determination that will get you to your goal. This is a kind of humility, because it is the ego that begins to work against us. It is the ego that begins to fight with us. And either it has an overinflated sense of itself, or it has an undervaluation of itself. It's either the top dog or the bottom dog. And in either way, it is ego. Your being, when you experience it as pure being, is at ease. It is at peace. It feels self-contained. And yet, it is connected with everyone and all of life about you. It's not as if you are holed up in some castle someplace, separated from the world. If you are there, you are not connected. Because spirit is connected with all of consciousness, all of humanity, so that these great spiritual masters, the Buddha, the Christ, and the others, had great compassion for this world, and great compassion for those who had fallen on hard times, who were having difficulties of it, and a lack of tolerance for those who could not tolerate such ones or took advantage of them or tried to put them down because of what they were experiencing in their lives. So that Jesus said, though that one without sin cast the first stone. And in the sand, he started to write out all the sins of all those who stood around him. And gradually, one by one, began to leave that place until only the woman is left with him. And he asked her, woman, where are those who would slay you? Who would stone you to death? She said, Master, they have all left. And then he instructed her and said, go out and sin no more. They do not condemn you, and neither do I. So condemnation is not from God. Rather, forgiveness and understanding comes from God. Now, this is not license to do whatever you want in your life and thinking that there is no consequences to it. That is not it at all. That's the ego when it grabs hold of it. It wants free license to do whatever it will. But when you surrender to this inner self completely, it is not around self-condemnation. That is wasted energy. Rather, you understand your fellow human beings, and you understand yourself. Sometimes it's most difficult to give ourselves any sense of understanding. We really pile it on when it comes to ourselves. And yet, in some ways, this is the ego in its greatest glory. For some individuals, the most difficult thing is overcoming egotism. Feeling that you are the best, you are the greatest, no one can come close to you. For others, the greatest temptation is in feeling sorry for itself, for feeling that it deserves to be down, to feel that it is not worthy. And when you recognize this for the ego trip that it is, it puts a fly in the ointment. Because when you are in that place, you think, you know, there's almost a sense that you deserve to be in that place and that that's the right place for you. When you see that that's just as big of an ego trip as the arrogant one who holds themselves aloft and separate from everyone, then you realize that it will get you nowhere. And that is not real humility. Sometimes people will try to pass it off as such. But real humility comes from the recognition that your life is not your own, that what animates you, what gives you intelligence and feeling and the ability to have a life comes from something beyond you. And you are but a witness of that higher consciousness and that greater life. And when you recognize that, you accept whatever that highest consciousness puts through you, whether it is through thoughts or words or deeds. And when you have totally dedicated yourself as an individual towards realizing that truth, and you begin to experience that consciousness to move through you, this puts into your mind real humility and real gratitude for what comes through you, because you realize that your life is not your own, but rather it is connected and intimately inspired by a greater life. And so this is the way that we progress upon this path. Mother told a wonderful story one time when she was meeting with a saint. And she, as she explained it, she said, God had quite an ego that day. And so she was kind of talking herself up a bit. And so at last, the saint said, well, Mother, he says, you know, we must remember to have humility. And she said, Swamiji, real humility is surrendering yourself completely to that highest consciousness and letting it act through you in any way that it will. So humility has no particular outward form or guise, but rather it is this inner awareness and inner understanding that you are not in control. You, in an individual sense, can be but a witness for what happens within you and through you. And that this greater life can pick you up and begin to put you through all those experiences that are required in order to know that infinite consciousness. When you think about it, if you had to make your own heartbeat, if you had to regulate your own digestion system, if you had to regulate your own breath all the time, you couldn't do it. You wouldn't know how to in the first place. And the number of complex mechanisms required to make that happen are quite beyond the conscious mind. And even so is it greater with our spiritual life, that if we had to know what it was in order to transform this consciousness from the human to the divine, we would not know where to start. And so the best that we can do is to put ourselves in cooperation with that highest consciousness. Even as if we want good health, we can begin to put ourselves into cooperation with healthful laws, healthful ways of living. But we of our own selves cannot create that health. That's something that our body does when it's given the right opportunity, when it's treated in the right way. And so it's the same true with your own spiritual life, that you of yourself cannot do it. But it is your Father who doeth the works. It is that infinite consciousness within you that picks you up and is able to make all the changes that you need to make. And the best that you can do is to put yourself into a conscious cooperation with that. And the best way to do that is to meditate deeply on God, chant God's name, and feel that presence and practice the presence of God in everything that you do. And when you go out and move in action, you act as a servant of God and a servant of God within everyone you meet. And when you encounter different situations, you see that God has organized that perfectly to help you bring yourself to a higher state of realization. And if you get hold of that idea like a tenacious dog and don't let go of it, it will take you directly into that highest state of consciousness, step by step. And then you will know the power and the wonder and the glory of what it is to live in that highest consciousness. And you will feel the peace of God. You will feel the bliss. So, to such a great degree that you do not feel like you contain it all, and you are like a container that has to burst open in order to let it all flow. There is such a great abundance of it. And so it breaks every form within you, the physical form, the feeling form, because you are overwhelmed on that level, and even the idea, the thought form, becomes overwhelmed with that tremendous sense of consciousness. And suddenly you realize there is nothing but that. There is not even a duality of myself and that consciousness, but rather even that sense of individuality breaks the bubble and becomes identified with that universal sea. And then if it is to be, you gradually bring that consciousness back down into this body, and you operate in this body even with that full consciousness of your oneness with God. But whatever the case, you dance to God's tune, because you see that this life is one wonderful movement of consciousness, and that it has sublime elements to it, and that it is ever-changing, ever-new, ever-blissful. And so God is playing hide-and-seek with the soul, and we are searching out for God, but God is hiding, waiting for us to discover him. And when we do, then you feel the great joy of discovery, even as mother and child feel the discovery. And in that moment, you run and dive into the arms of the infinite, and it takes you, and you and that become as one. And this is our ultimate destiny as human beings, and as all of humanity, for we are all come from God, all, and that is to where we must return. There is no exceptions, for where can there be? Where can there be? Because all is one. All is part of that one infinite consciousness.